The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Purposefully, I'm going to keep my remarks very practical, and I want to try to cover all the material and give an opportunity for questions and hopefully some answers in the next hour. I think that's the format that is being used. I remember when I got the letter from Dr. Fuller and then a follow-up letter from Dr. Greenway about this matter of lecturing in this series and then the subject, the revitalization of a dying church or dying churches. And then came I was just sharing with Dr. Greenway that then came the request, would you put this down and possibly use it as a chapter in a book that he's doing? And I was somewhat fearful to do that, but then I began to do it, and then the more I began to do it, the more my heart began to warm to the subject, particularly not so much the subject of ministry of revitalization. Up until now, by the way, so I may use this term every once in a while when I get excited and start talking. I may use the term reclamation, because up until I was giving this title, that's what I used to call this ministry, the ministry of reclamation. But the more I began to write about it, the more I really became excited about this, the possibilities that are before us, and the relevancy of this particular subject. Now, I realize that I've not been exposed to many Westminster students, and unfortunately, many of the Westminster students perhaps have not been exposed to ministry in terms of responsibility, because if they had, and if I could have talked to them, they would have seen that I believe what we're covering tonight is one of the most crucial issues they'll face if they're considering going into the pastorate. I want to explain to you why in just a few moments. Let me first of all give you a definition of what I believe we're talking about when we're talking about revitalization or the process of revitalization and the ministry of revitalization. What we're talking about the idea of being a revitalization pastor, a pastor of a revitalization ministry. This is what I think we're talking about. We're talking about seeking to be an instrument in the hands of a sovereign God that will be used to breathe life back into a body of believers. To be an instrument in the hands of a sovereign God that will be used to breathe life back into a body of believers before that organism becomes nothing more than a corpse. Placing your ministry in the hands of God, trusting in His sovereign purposes and in His clearly stated in His Word, His sovereign purposes are for the well-being of the church. He is about the building of the church. He has a concern for churches that are less than what they ought to be. So we place ourselves, our ministry, in His hands, the hands of a sovereign God, seeking to be used by Him to breathe life back into a body of believers before the organism becomes nothing more than a corpse. Now, how would you do that? How would you do that as a pastor? Now, up until this time, let me tell you what I used to say. The Lord brings things back to you, to haunt you. I'll tell you. He did this with me. I first started out as a pastor of an independent church, and I used to make this statement. All these dead and dying churches, you just might as well, they might as well go ahead and die, get the remnant out, and go start something new. And then when I got to Miami and God laid this congregation upon my heart, the Lord was just saying, hey, the ball's in your court, now dribble it. And I really had to begin to think through this revitalization project, this ministry. What does it mean? And as I sat down to write some things for this lecture, as I went into that ministry in 1980 at Pinelands Presbyterian Church in Miami, Florida, later at Christ Covenant in Charlotte, North Carolina, I could not find anything that was written specifically to this issue. Yet I believe it's a prevalent issue. I couldn't find anything anywhere. It was very much like if I was standing at an elevator, say you're at a downtown office building, you're standing at the elevator, and the elevator comes down, you push the button, the elevator comes down, the elevator doors open, and there's a group of people all with horror upon their face and laying right on the floor as someone that's just had a heart attack. They're turning blue, and they look at you, and they say, help. What would you do? How would you go about helping that particular individual that's laying there, about to die? What would you do to breathe life back into that person before they became a corpse? That's where many pastors find themselves. They go to a church, they get there, when they're ready to start ministry, they find out that they've got something that's just about to turn blue, just about to give up the ghost, just about to die, and the people are saying, help, and he's really not sure what he ought to be doing. Much of our education and preparation for the ministry is done in theoretical terms and under so-called idealistic situations, or the idea of going out and starting new works. All of those things are before us. But what about revitalization? Well, what happened as I began to think through this is the first thing I did was to begin to think through a philosophy of ministry, and that's what I want to begin sharing with you. In terms of a philosophy of ministry, see how this comes up. I went to Ephesians 4, 11 through 16. I'm sure you're familiar with the passage. I'm not going to take time to deal with this in any great detail, but in Ephesians 4, 11 through 16, there are some challenges concerning the ministry. I'm going to say, what is my position? Well, my position is one of pastor-teacher. That's what the Scriptures, I believe, call me to do. What's my purpose? My purpose is to equip the saints. What's my objective? My objective is that in the equipping of the saints, they can do the work of the ministry. I need to communicate that right away. I try to do it in very down-to-earth terms. I tell people, look, you can call me pastor. Pastor-teacher is the title that I use because I think it's a functional title that communicates meaning to people. And I tell them, I say, look, I'm not the minister. I'm the equipment manager. In fact, I had a lady the other day, we were out visiting some people, and we were out at a social event, and one of the ladies in our church was there, and she says, hey, I want you to meet my equipment manager. And that's the way she introduced me to her friend, and that opened up the door for her to share what our church was all about and how the pastor functioned in that church. And then, what do? I equip the saints, discipling them, for the objective of what? That they would learn to do the work of the ministry. Now, let's go to another point, and that's the categories of ministry that are available or that are before us. Now, this is where I begin to do quite a bit of thinking that I want to share with you. As I looked at the various ministries that are available, that are out there, I put them into three basic categories, okay? Those three basic categories are, first of all, organizing pastor. Organizing pastors. And I would divide organizing pastors into two types. An organizing pastor is someone that's obviously very effective, someone who is very skilled, someone who is very adept, someone who is an evangelist. He has organizational gifts, administrative gifts, and he, of course, must be a self-starter. Great capacity for work. I divide them into two categories. The organizing pastors that come in and start works, and then after the work is viable, they move on to another work. There are many men that are great at starting works as an organizing pastor, but after it gets to a certain level, the very strengths that help them as a self-starter, that help them really move ahead, become liabilities in trying to work with a growing organism. And so they need to move on and start another work. Are there some who start works and have the ability to make that transition as the church grows and there's more organization and there are more responsibilities? An example would be, I think you're going to have Jim Kennedy here for this series of lectures as well. Example would be Jim Kennedy as he came as an organizing pastor, went through what he went through, and as the church has grown, he's been able to adapt with his own particular skills and strengths and move ahead, and the ministry has continued to prosper. He didn't need to move on after the church became viable at a certain size, but he stayed with it. The second category I'd like to talk about are continuing pastors. Continuing pastors. Now, what is a continuing pastor? Well, a continuing pastor is someone who comes into a successful work and keeps it going. Someone who steps into a ministry that is growing and he seeks to continue its expansion. Now, this is a challenge. A guy obviously has to be effective. He has to be secure. He has to be his own man. There's a brother of mine that's pastoring a church down in South Florida, and there was a church that was very successful. The pastor died suddenly. He was coming out of seminary, but he was an older man, so they asked him up, and they asked him to candidate there. So he went there to candidate. When he got there to candidate, older lady after the service came up to him, and she said, young man, that was a mighty fine sermon. But, you know, if you come here, you're going to have some big shoes to fill. And he turned around to her, and he said, ma'am, if I come here, I'll bring my own shoes. It's that simple. Now, if he didn't mean it in a very, if he didn't mean it in an arrogant way, he did have the right approach when he was coming. He was not coming to repeat, but to build and to bring his own ministry, and he had to be secured. If you're a Baptist, think about following Jerry Falwell down in Lynchburg. Who's going to follow him? If you're a PCA pastor, who's going to step in at Coral Ridge Presbyterian and follow Jim Kennedy in that particular ministry? Because, the Lord, he may move on and the Lord may take him home. Who's going to follow him? Frank Barker, Briarwood Presbyterian. Those are successful churches that God is blessing, and somebody's going to have to follow them, and somebody has to have a peculiar gift to do that. The third category, which you probably already are ready for, is the revitalization pastor. Revitalization pastor. And once again, I divide those into two categories. You say, is there any other category? I don't think so. I really don't. Organizing pastors, starting new works. Continuing pastors, coming into a successful, a growing church. To some degree or another, the church is moving ahead. And then there's the revitalization pastor. See, I'm convinced that Christians don't plateau. They don't get into a status quo position. They're either growing or they're declining. I think the same thing's true in churches. They're either moving ahead or they're in some degree of decline and are in need of revitalization. So what about a revitalization pastor? Well, the two types that I would say are, first of all, let me give you an example of type one. It's comparable to the organizing pastor, the guy that comes in and organizes a work and moves on after 3 or 4 or 5 years whenever the church becomes viable to start another work. There are revitalization pastors that are that way, that come into something that is suffering, that's in decline. The Lord uses them to turn the church around, and then they're challenged to move on to another work. Let me give you an example. A guy that's just a dear brother that has really helped me in my ministry is a guy by the name of James Baird. Jim Baird has done this now 5 times in his ministry. He has come into downtown, or usually downtown churches, First Presbyterian type churches, in various areas such as Gadsden, such as Macon. He was down in Grenada when I was in South Florida. And he comes into churches that are experiencing some kind of decline, and God blesses his ministry. And after 4 or 5 years, he begins to move on to another work. And he's done this now in about 5 situations. Another type is the revitalization pastor, which I hope I fit into this category, that maybe does it a few times, but he finally ends up somewhere where the Lord is blessing, and the Lord says, hey, I want you to stay there. And I'm praying. We just had a missions conference last week, and at the end of it, Clyde Godwin, a graduate of Westminster Seminary, who we had as our speaker, he asked for all of those who would be committed to go anywhere the Lord called them to go to stand up. And so I stood up, and the Lord really touched my heart for that, and I've thought about missions a lot, and I stood up, but inside I was talking to the Lord. I was praying about it, and I said, Lord, first of all, I would rather go to Africa than up north. That's the first thing I'd like to say to you. The second thing is I'm hoping and praying you're going to want me to stay here for a while. But revitalization pastors that God uses, and then they stay there. Now, there are so many passages of Scripture that deal with this matter of revitalization. I would encourage you to take the time to begin to look at those passages of Scripture. If you want to see revitalization projects, take a look at Revelation chapters 2 and 3, the 7 churches. At least 4 of those churches, and really 5 of those churches, are challenges to revitalization. You've got the church at Ephesus, Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, and Laodicea. Those are revitalization pastorates that the ministers are being challenged to set something back to where it should be. How about the ministry of Titus? Remember it? Titus chapter 1, verse 5. Paul sends him to Crete. What does he say? Set in order what remains. Decline had taken place. And he said, now take what remains and get it in order. Revitalization. Perhaps the best study would be the church at Ephesus. It has a tremendous, noble beginning. It starts in Acts 18. You go to Acts 20. You can pick up the flavor of the church in the epistle to the Ephesians, then 1st and 2nd Timothy, and then Revelation 2, 1 through 7. The church starts with these noble beginnings of Aquila and Priscilla and their ministry, the lengthy ministry of the Apostle Paul, the noble ministry of Apollos. By Acts 20, things are going so well that this church is sending out people everywhere. Probably Ephesus was used to establish anywhere from 8 to 11 other churches in the immediate area. It was growing. It was vital. It was viable. Acts 20, Paul gives a warning. In the midst of great affection with these elders, he gives a warning to them. that among their own selves there are going to be wolves that will come up and do destruction to the flock. So he warns them. Then all of a sudden we pick up the book of Ephesians, and we find Paul exhorting them to greater things concerning the glories of Christ and his church. Then comes 1 and 2 Timothy. What's happened? The church is in decline. Paul is sending his most trusted disciple back to get Ephesus on the right track. All kinds of problems. Then a generation, perhaps two generations later, you've got the Apostle John writing, and this is what he says to that church. Remember your first love. Once again, they were a candidate for revitalization. The more I've thought about this, the more I've seen the revitalization ministry as an exciting challenge. There are all kinds of positives to it. There are all kinds of negatives to it. But I believe it is particularly relevant to seminarians, as well as many men that are in the ministry. Think about it. First of all, it's my conviction that an organizing pastor has to have certain skills and gifts. The organizing pastorate is not for men that just can't get a call anywhere else. So let's go start a church. The organizing pastorate is for men who are gifted in that area. There are so many things requisite to the ministry of an organizing pastor. It's not just the last ditch effort to get into the ministry because one can't get anywhere else. Think about it. How many graduating seminarians are going to be called to a successful church? Not many. My own opinion, and by the way, in terms of organizing pastors, I appreciate all that the PCA is doing in this area. I think we even ought to go a step further. I think basically, and there's a tremendous movement, I think basically organizing pastors ought to have had at least one successful pastorate before they're authorized to be an organizing pastor. I'm not saying that. I think there are exceptional cases, but those ought to be exceptional cases. But I am convinced that 90 to 95% of the men that leave this seminary or any other seminary that go straight to a senior pastorate will be faced with a church that is in some degree of decline or decay. And they expect them to revitalize that work. 90 to 95% of the men that go, if they don't go into a staff position or they're not an organizing pastor or something like that, they're going to be confronted with it. So that's two conclusions I'd like to share with you. The first one is that the majority of pastors will face revitalization projects. Secondly, each church in every generation is a candidate for revitalization ministry. You see, each church has to own, in each successive generation, it has to own the call to make the biblical principles alive in that congregation. We can't just by our heritage make people alive. What did it say? What does the Word of God say as various churches such as Sardis are faced in Revelation? I know that you have a name, tradition, that you're alive. But in fact, you're dead. Because each generation has to capture that vision of a biblical church. So revitalization not only faces us because the majority of churches are in that situation, but every church, each generation is a candidate for revitalization. Well, that's some of the conclusions that I faced. And what I'd like to do with you is I'd like to take the time to give to you some ideas about revitalization. I want to give a disclaimer here first. The disclaimer is that there is no way that I can totally handle this issue tonight. I'm just going to hit the highlights, and hopefully in the question and answer period I can embellish it some and work on it. But what I'd like to do is to divide what we're going to cover now into two sections. The first section is the prevailing dynamics in a dying church. The second section will be the principled dynamics of a living church. First of all, the prevailing dynamics in dying churches. That's what we'll face first, but I want to try to make this relevant to you, as relevant as I can. You get a call from a church. It's South Florida, Miami. And the people say, we'd like for you to be our pastor. Let me give you the scenario. The church is 28 years old. At one time, about 14 years ago, it had a membership of 900. Four major worship services every Lord's Day, a creative youth ministry noted for its commitment to world evangelism, a plant that was the envy of many, located in one of the fastest growing regions in the United States. And that particular work had now come to the place from 900 to an average attendance of less than 50, including children, every Sunday. There was vandalism every single day. Graffiti, lights broken out, windows being smashed. The people were discouraged. All of the so-called spiritual and mature had left and gone to other works. Just less than 2 miles away was one of the largest churches in the PCA denomination. This church that had once been a flagship church, now people were saying things like it ought to be closed up. We ought to just to leave it alone. Sunday school, average attendance was 16. If you had maybe three children, it had not met the budget in 3 years, really four, but we can say for sure three. The only thing that had kept it alive was a Christian school and its surpluses, because it operated in the black. Yet not one faculty member from that Christian school that the church sponsored went to the church, nor one family of one student went to that church. 125 students, not one student or family went to the church that the schools that was supported by the school. Not one faculty member participated. What else can I tell you about it? The grass wasn't cut, that's for sure. There were all kinds of problems everywhere. The people just were totally disillusioned. They lived in the shadow of a fast-growing church. Their neighborhood was disintegrating all around them. What in the world could be done? Well, that's what I faced when we went to Pinelands in Miami, Florida. In fact, one pastor even took me aside to tell me, "Harry, don't go there." And this was his work. Here's what he said. He said, "That church has the mark of Satan on it." How'd you like that in your call? "That church has the mark of Satan upon it." A lot of other things I could tell you, but let me tell you this. Church growth experts had come into it and analyzed it. I mean, you know, the guys that are noted for church growth in various ministries. They came in, analyzed it, put it through the computer, and came out with two recommendations. Both really just one recommendation. The first recommendation was sell the property and cut your losses and put whatever you can get out of it into a church planting fund in the presbytery. The second recommendation was sell the church property, take the money, and go to another neighborhood because this neighborhood is torn apart. There is no principle of homogeneity. Therefore, you need to just go somewhere else while this neighborhood's in transition. Later on, when the neighborhood settles, you can start another work there. But go somewhere else where there is a principle, where there is some principle of homogeneity, and you can expect growth. Those are the two recommendations from the church growth experts. Other pragmatists were just saying, "Get out! Don't go in. The church is dead. If it's not, we'll go ahead and strangle it." Then you get a call about the last week of your decision. You get a call from a church. By the way, the average age is over 50 in this church. In fact, you being 33 are the youngest person there, besides your children. I'll never forget when one of the ladies came up and said, "Oh, we're so glad to have you, and a young man." And one of them called me a boy one time. We had Dr. Clowney down to preach the week that I just started there. You know who he is, right? Great sermon. Before my wife and I could get to the back door to shake hands, the parking lot was empty. Everyone was gone. They were all gone. One of the elders' idea of growth was, "Well, maybe we need a Coca-Cola machine for the youth." There was ignorance, there was immaturity, there was despair. It was all of it was there. And then right the last week, you get a call from a church that average age is 29. They've gone from 2 to 450 in the last 2 years. There is a nice salary and all the perks and everything. And then you've got to make a decision between those two calls. Well, I knew that that call that was developing the other one was a real test of my fidelity. Was that church to be closed or not? And I was convinced that the doors of Pinelands did not need to be closed. It did not need to at all. So we went. Now let me tell you what you find when you go there. The dynamics in dying churches. First of all is the dynamic of reputation or image. When you get there, you're going to find, once again, I want to tell you, these are not all the dynamics. These are just some to give you tonight in the brief time that we have together. The reputation image dynamic. In other words, when you get there, you're going to find that the community and the surrounding churches have assigned a reputation and an image to that church. They're going to have a name. It's going to be the church that whatever. All of the church people that have left that church, they're going to have horror stories about what that church is really like, and that's going to spread like wildfire. They're going to go around and say, hey, do you want the inside info about what Pinelands is really like? And all of those things are going to be all out and about, and that's what you're going to have to combat, that reputation and image that is always negative. And it's an obstacle. I mean, it is a real obstacle to a fair hearing of the gospel and a fair hearing of what that church's ministry is all about. People have just kind of a knowing attitude. I can't tell you how many families would come and visit, like what they saw, even though they saw that we were just at the beginning stages of revitalization. But then they would tell somebody that they're going there, and then that person would say, well, you know what that church did a year and a half or 2 years ago? And you'd never see them again. So reputation or image is the first dynamic. The second dynamic is nostalgia. They remember the glory days. Believe me, they remember the glory days. They're living in the past, and you'll find that you were called not with hope in the future, you were called with the hope of recapturing the past. Recapturing the glory days. They'll tell you about all that they used to have and they want that again. My response to that was twofold. First of all, the Bible tells me not to live in the past but to press on. The second thing, I've told them right from the pulpit, I said, if yesteryear was so great, why are we in the condition we're in today? If yesteryear was so great, why are we in the condition that we're in today? You've got to remember that the river, and they've got to see, that the river of nostalgia has a sweeping current that takes people down to destruction and despair. God's people must look forward. They must look to the future. And if they can't, then they don't have a vision of the gospel. The gospel leads us forward, not backward to what we had. Thirdly, you'll find that the church is tradition bound. Tradition bound. You see, they've got all the tradition that is all... Let me give you an example. When I got to Pinelands, there were 40-something people sitting out there in a worship service. You could have took a cannon, put it up at the pulpit, loaded it with grape shot, fired it right back through the middle of the sanctuary and not hit a single soul. And one of the elders asked me, when can we start two services? Now, you know why? Glory days, they had how many? Four. And their idea was if we can get back to that tradition of multiple services, then we'll have life. They don't remember that they had to have multiple services because of growth. They think multiple services will create growth. The traditions that are binding the church. Now, I want to give you a positive note about traditions. A lot of you say, man, I don't ever want to face that. Well, you probably will face it, whether you want to or not. But let me tell you, somebody say, hey, I want to be an organizing pastor. In fact, a brother and I were talking about this last night. He was asking me some questions about it. He said, I want to be an organizing pastor. I want to just start from scratch. Let me give you my involvement as an organizing pastor and my assessment of that. This is a generalization. But I find it true in so many situations of the men that I'm on an M&A committee working with organizing pastors all the time. You see, when I went to Pinelands, I had an entrenched tradition. And you say, an organizing pastor, he doesn't have any traditions to face. Not so. Well, let's say you've got an organizing core group of 40 people. That's a large one, but let's just say you got it so we can make it comparable to what I faced in Pinelands with 40 people in a revitalization project. Now, what you think about it. Those 40 people, the vast majority of them are with you because they can't get along anywhere else. In fact, McNair points this out in his book to the point that he'll tell you that after 3 years, it's been his experience that 90% of the people that are in an organizing core group are not there at the end of 3 years. 90% of them are gone. And they'll go on to another organizing group. And what you face so many times is not one dead tradition, you face 40 traditions. Every single one of those people have an idea of what the church is supposed to be and what it's supposed to be like, and you have not proven them wrong yet. At least the dead tradition is dead. For instance, in the Sunday Bible school, we went to an elective system at Pinelands. They were averaging 16 in Sunday Bible school. At the end of two quarters, we were averaging 85 in Sunday Bible school. One of the guys said, "I miss our old fellowship Sunday school class. Let's leave the elective system," one of the elders said to me, "and go back to the old system." I said, "Do you want to leave 85 and go back to 16? We're reaching these people that are hungry for the Word of God?" And he said, "No, I don't." At least there was the ability to look at one tradition that was dead. It was proven to be dead. It had been proven to be dead instead of looking at something that that idealistically 45, 25, or 30 people or 40 people think is going to work. Well, let me give you the fourth dynamic. The fourth dynamic is that the church that you go to in a revitalization pastor, as a revitalization pastor, is prepared for defeat. They're like the sports team that has been playing for 10 years and lost every game for 10 years. And they have a list of excuses to explain away the certain defeats of the future. They know nothing's going to work. For instance, when I went to Miami, I shared some things with the elders that I asked them to agree to if I was to come. And when we went through those things, one of the things is I have a personal conviction about the necessity and the helpfulness of a Sunday evening service. They had canceled theirs long ago. So I got them to agree to start one, and they would commit to come to it, and we'd see what would begin to happen. And as we were sitting there, I'll never forget, as I explained to them why a Sunday evening, I got a list of, must have been 20 excuses as to why a Sunday evening service could never succeed in that church. And in the grace of God, in 2.5 years, our Sunday evening service was 70% to 80% of Sunday morning. But they already had the excuses as to why it couldn't work. Prepared for defeat. Fifth, you'll find that the church is in disrepair. The buildings, the facilities, the organization, the infrastructure, the programs, it's all in disrepair. One of my elders in Miami said to me, he said, "Harry," he said, "you don't know how bad shape this building's in." And Jack said to me, he said, "If the termites quit holding hands, we're in trouble." That's how bad it was. Our great goal was to have enough money to be able to get the thing tinted and fumigated so that it would stand and wouldn't be eaten away right before us. There are all kinds of problems. And you'll find that the ministries have been lopped off as there was no money available, with no thought about a cohesive ministry structure at all. It's just, well, we can't afford this anymore. Let's drop this. Let's drop that. We can't do this with the youth. We can't do that. And so there will be disrepair of the infrastructure as well as the facilities, the structure of ministry, the infrastructure of ministry. And then finally, there will be unrealistic expectations. You see, you are being called as the miracle worker. By the way, go back with me to disrepair for a minute. Two warnings, whether you're an organizing pastor or a revitalization pastor. Never let God's people nor yourself make the land purchase, the buildings, the facilities, the building of them or the repair of them. Never let those become the focus. It's going to be an unbelievable letdown once you get it done. Make those activities as part of the spiritual journey that congregation is in. Let me give you an example. At Christ Covenant, we got there and there was 35 people in Charlotte. We had 4 acres and a trailer. I'll never forget my daughter, when we went up there and we were thinking about going, she said to me, she said, "Daddy, are we going to leave Miami?" And they didn't want to, obviously. And I said, "Well, Abby, I'm not sure whether we are or not. We're going to pray about it and we're going to see." And she said, "Well, Daddy, where are we going?" And I said, "Well, I don't know." And she said, "Daddy, are we going up to Charlotte where that church meets in a camper?" That's what she called a trailer, a camper. We outgrew it. 4 acres of land was there. It was not enough for the ministry. So we prayed about facilities. We didn't make it an object to move to facilities. We just prayed about facilities. And we began to pray about them. God miraculously opened, I can't explain to you the situation in Southeast Charlotte, but He miraculously opened up the only possible place where we could meet, Charlotte Christian School. That school had never been vacant. Church after church goes in there to start. But all of a sudden, right when we needed it and we were praying about it, that school opened up. Can you imagine what that meant to the encouragement of these people as they made that a part of their spiritual adventure? And then we began to pray about land. And we came up against it and up against it and up against it. And I said, "Look, the land's not the goal. The goal is the glory of God. So let's make the purchase of land, like everything else, abound to the glory of God. Let's pray about it." The elders and deacons, we got 2 offers on 2 pieces of land that we could have obtained. But they knew that wasn't right. There was a piece that we felt like God was leading us to. We weren't claiming it or anything. We just felt God was leading it to us. And we said, "Okay, men." One of the deacons spoke up at a joint elder and deacon meeting. He said, "Listen, let's make it a matter of prayer and fasting for that piece of land, 31 acres. We began to pray about it. That man had already turned us down twice. So we decided every Monday would be a day of prayer and fasting about the land situation, specifically focused on that one. Our first Monday came, prayer and fasting. Tuesday, we got a phone call from the owner of that property making us a new deal that was better than the one we had offered him for us. The land was not the goal. It was the way it was attained. And the people have been excited about it ever since. We had our first payment. Our first payment was $189,000. And we began to pray about it. And just pray about it. And ask God to do it in such a way. We said, "We're not going to make it an issue. We're not going to bring a fundraiser in. We're not going to do this. What we're going to do is seek the Lord. Make the need known. Give everybody a chance to give sacrificially and all of that." And we had a special meeting on a Sunday evening after the worship service. And the goal was $189,000. And guess what came in? $188,236. I wish you could have seen the faces of those people, particularly when a man stood up in the congregation and said, "I'll give the rest of it." And it was all taken care of. It was a goal. It was something that we were aiming at that was not the land itself, but the process of obtaining it. And I was so thrilled as I went through the community the next week, and people were talking throughout the community, not about the land that we got, but the way God gave it to that church. It became an evangelistic tool. People began to visit the congregation because they heard about it. So whether you're fixing up something in a revitalization project or you're having to, never make the facilities the goal. They're a means to an end. Make it just as much a part of the spiritual journey of a church as anything else. Well, the last one was unrealistic expectations. You're called. The church that needs revitalization is like a man dying with cancer. And they think you're going to come up with the miracle cure. Now, the cure is the miraculous, the supernatural grace of God. They think you're going to come up with that cure. It's going to be instant. It's going to be a miracle cure. That's the way we are in our society. We've got instant coffee. We've got instant grits. We've got instant cereal. We've got instant everything else. We're going to get instant revitalization. They have to be challenged to see that that's not the way it's done. It's done by laying the blocks, the spiritual foundation properly and beginning to build. The spiritually mature have gone. They're not around any longer. And so all of these people that are there do not realize that, and they think it's going to be done overnight. And their expectations have got to be redirected. Well, you know, these things, as I've sat and gone through them with you again, as I've written on them, they just come alive to me every time. I think of that reputation image, the nostalgia, the tradition bound, the prepared for defeat, disrepair, unrealistic expectations. It's just unbelievable the things that are faced in that kind of situation. But boy, what a challenge. What an opportunity to reclaim something for the glory of God. And you know, the world takes a look. The world really, really examines that kind of situation. And if God turns it around, there are just fantastic opportunities to share who has done it and how He has done it. Let me give you an example of what I believe should be done. Let's look at the principal dynamics of living churches. How to bring it back to life by the grace of God. Number one is vision. Number one is vision. Proverbs chapter 22, verse 4. Without a vision, the people perish. Now, I know there is quite a bit of discussion in the area of the translation of that. Without a revelation, the people wander, or they're misdirected. And that's true. And I believe that enhances what I'm about to tell you. Vision, a church must have vision. Not a backward vision, but a forward vision. That vision must be of a certain type, but they must have a vision because a vision unifies people. And a vision propels them in a certain direction. And without it, they begin to scatter. Without it, they begin to wander. You see, you've got to replace that reputation, that image, with a vision for what the church is really supposed to be like. That vision that will unify, and that vision that is biblical. The vision must be built. I know this has been misused so many times for pastors to promote building programs and this and that and the other, and they put at the bottom of the thing, without a vision, the people perish. But the principle is still true. The thing that we have to do is not make that some kind of a vision that's wood, hay, and stubble, but a vision that is biblical, a vision that is real, and communicate to the people what Christ wants to do with that church. There are a lot of ingredients about a vision, but let me say something first of all about how you obtain a vision, or what do you do in the process of developing that vision. Okay? First of all, the development of a vision, I think, has five parts to it. First of all, are biblical principles. That's number one. What is the church supposed to be? The second thing is, what are the strengths of your leadership? Yours personally, as well as the existing leadership. What are the strengths of it? What are the limitations? The third thing is, what are the strengths of the congregation? For instance, where we are right now, we're meeting in rented facilities, a gymnasium. Well, it's very difficult for us to do concerts in something like that. So Christ's Covenant is not known for its concerts. But we do have a fellowship ministry that is very attractive, that people are very excited about, because a gymnasium can be used that way. And our congregation has that strength. What spiritual strengths are there? What spiritual gifts are there? In the providence of God, Christ's Covenant is attracting a lot of people with great counseling gifts. I feel I have a weakness in counseling. I make that very clear. But I also make it clear that these people have a real strength. And so a lot of people are involved in counseling / discipleship type ministries. Number four, what are the ministries of the surrounding churches? Before I left Miami to go to Charlotte, I took time to visit the successful evangelical, conservative, reformed, fundamental churches in the area. Those that were proclaiming the gospel. And I sat down and talked with each pastor. Because I'll be honest with you, if I felt I was going to duplicate something that somebody else was doing, I was not going. I'd just rather them travel another mile and go there. I didn't think there's any reason for me to duplicate. What's going on in the surrounding churches, and therefore, what is the niche that you can occupy? In Charlotte, we have one church that is noted for its evangelism. We have another church that's noted for its equipping ministries. So what have we attempted to do at Christ's Covenant? The vision includes balance. Our goal is discipleship, and we're attempting to balance both the activity of evangelism with equipping. And we're attempting to win people to Christ and train them and send them to do others. Not just one-dimensional, but multidimensional. So what are the ministries of the surrounding churches? And then finally, what are the needs of the community? This was really, this really came home to me in Miami. Remember that diversified community? The community was changing rapidly. It was changing racially. It was mixed. Blue collar, white collar, social strata. It was everything in Miami. It was just a total hodgepodge. Now, the church growth people said, hey, there's no principle of homogeneity yet in this neighborhood, so you can't grow. I said, well, I think there is a principle of homogeneity. Number one, all of them are sinners. Number two, gospel can save every one of them. That was my little bone to pick at that point. But then I said, what about in our vision, a multiracial, cultural, multi-social strata congregation? I mean, let's make that instead of a certain middle class or upper class or lower class or anything, or black or white or Jamaican or American. What about a multi-dimensional church, racially, economically, socially, and all of that? Well, that was a little tough at the beginning as we began to talk about it with those 40 people that were there that were not multi-anything. But when we began to talk about it, began to look at what God could do, they kind of got excited about it. And in 1983, when God called me to leave, I remember standing up and looking out at that congregation, seeing a congregation with over 20 different nationalities, seeing a congregation with one-third of it black, Jamaican black, American black, Latin American, Korean, Mexican, right across the board. The only thing that I think necessarily breaks a congregation up is language. I think there was a reason for the Tower of Babel. That's the only thing I think that necessarily divides a congregation. And to see those people in a worship service holding hands together and singing, "I'm so glad to be a part of the family of God." That was a vision. That was the community, so the needs of the community dictated some to us about what our vision had to be.